I'm a hypocrite. I ask for sincerity and I lie. I denounce the system as I embrace it. I want money and power and prestige. I want ratings and success. I don't give a damn about you or the world. That's the truth. For this, I could say I'm sorry, but I won't. Why should I? I mean, who the hell are you anyways, you audience? You're on me every night like a pack of wolves because you can't stand facing what you are and what you've made. Yes, the world is a terrible place. Yes, cancer and garbage disposals will get you. Yes, a war is coming. Yes, the world is shut to hell and you're all goners. Everything's screwed up and you like it that way, don't you? You're fascinated by the gory details. You're mesmerized by your own fear. You revel in floods, car accidents, unstoppable diseases. You're happiest when others are in pain. That's where I come in, isn't it? I'm here to lead you by the hand through the dark forest of your own hatred and anger and humiliation. I'm providing a public service. You're so scared. You're like a little child under the covers. You're afraid of the boogeyman, but you can't live without him. Your fear, your own lives have become your entertainment. Marvelous technology is at our disposal. Instead of reaching up to new heights, we're trying to see how far down we can go. How deep into the muck we can immerse ourselves.
Revel in unstoppable diseases, eh? That was from Eric Bogosian and Oliver Stone's 1988 underrated film, Talk Radio. So relevant as meat sacks today project their masochistic narcissism like never before. Not upon talk radio, but the marvelous technology of the internet that's bringing humanity deep into the muck, as character Gary Champlain says in the clip. It's symbiotic and diabolical, and you know who you are because you've been offended recently on social media and got so indignant you had to witch hunt vent in your confirmation bias Facebook wall or some WhatsApp private group. Yes, you secretly love those you claim to hate and relish in the destruction of those you claim to love. You're mesmerized and addicted to fear porn. Crave the digital adrenaline of self-righteous, self-loathing psychic cocktails.
If people can't control their own emotions, then they have to start trying to control other people's behavior.
You see this crack and Karen energy everywhere today, on Twitter or Instagram, on podcasts and YouTube comments. It's a Stockholm Syndrome orgy, a doom scroll plunge into the underworlds of despondency masked as heroic martyrdom. It's disgusting and an egregore shadow like never before in Western culture, here at the end of the world in this age of Hermes.
Everybody just yells and screams at each other. Nobody's civil anymore. Nobody thinks what it's like to be the other guy.
And it's the same with Hollywood for all of us. We hate but can't escape Hollywood. We know it's an archontic cesspool, but we want more of that escapist delirium. Heck and heckity, look at me making my points by using movie clips and references. And why not? Hollywood is the primary font of myth, magic, and meaning today. But Hollywood has also weaponized myth, magic, and meaning to cuck and coal all that is imaginative, to social engineer a society into numb slaves, to close the doorways to the imaginal realms and open the very gates of hell. We all know this. Even as we languish in a synergetic, abusive relationship with Hollywood.
How are you to imagine anything if the images are always provided for you? To deliberately believe in lies while knowing they're false.
Carl Jung did say, "The reason for evil in the world is that people are not able to tell their stories." Today, with Hollywood, not only can we not tell our stories, but our stories are told for us. Wrapped in oligarch agenda and infused with soul-castrating enchantments. And the gates of hell open more. Well played, Archons. Well played. What do you think?
Sir, this is a Wendy's.
Okay, never mind. But you true seeker warriors are probably wondering what can be done.
Once again, things that could have been brought to my attention yesterday!
Much can be done, and our astral guest always provides those red pill suppositories that crack and melt real nice in these outer rectums of reality. You'll be gaining that gnosis to paradoxically exercise and integrate all those demons coming out of the gates of hell that Hollywood broke open.
If you're frightened of dying and you're holding on, you'll see devils tearing your life away. But if you've made your peace, then the devils are really angels freeing you from the earth.
So please welcome Jason Horsley, who materializes at the virtual Alexandria again to discuss his new book, 16 Maps of Hell, The Unraveling of Hollywood Superculture. What a powerful and profound read, I say. Disturbing and elevating at the same time. I love all that Jason produces, and you won't be disappointed with the interview. Hell is closed and all the demons are here, as Shakespeare claimed. But we are the freaking outcasts, the sons and daughters of Hermes, the god of thieves, and Sophia, the goddess of smugglers. As the world burns in madness, we rise from the ashes of forgotten gods and one more time steal the fire of creator gods and their butt slaves in the establishment.
We see the world the way it really is, and hope that one day all mankind might see the same.
What is the world, then?
An illusion. One which we can either submit to, as most do, or transcend.
What is it to transcend?
To recognize nothing is true and everything is permitted.
Here we go again, White Snake, at Aeon Byte Gnostic Wadio. I, your host Miguel Connor, that pompous of Gnosis, is honored to serve you as always. We run with those searching for the truth and avoid those who have found it. We're raging against heaven and storming the open gates of hell for our misplaced childhoods and paradises lost. We are the veterans of 1,000 psychic wars, Johnny Cash bodhisattvas, and spiritual entrepreneurs.
Where there is fire, we will carry gasoline.
I read this quote to Jason in a section of our interview from 60 Maps of Hell. But I'd like to read it again for you, since it contains part of our liberation. Since there is nothing, finally, that is not nature, there is nothing that can replace or distort or corrupt nature. There are only endless strategies of distraction, a marketplace of attention, and elaborately built devils to prolong our agony and delay our inevitable awakening. The forgotten chamber of hell plays endless reruns to keep us enthralled. But there are no movies in heaven.
He said the only thing that burns in hell is the part of you that won't let go of your life. Your memories, your attachments, they burn them all away. But they're not punishing you, he said. They're freeing your soul.
No, my beloved true seekers. No movies in heaven, or the Pleroma, if you would. There is only tapping indirectly to myth, magic, and meaning. Being one with eternal imagination. Finally telling our stories instead of the bullshit the angelic ghostwriters of Yaldibaldi come up with. As Christopher Morley said, My theology, briefly, is that the universe was dictated but not signed.
What unites people? Armies? Gold? Flags? Stories? There's nothing in the world more powerful than a good story. Nothing can stop it. No enemy can defeat it. And who has a better story?
All we have to do is stop playing the game of Saturn, divorce those endless strategies of distraction and the marketplace of attention. All we have to do is let go of our heroes and villains, reject the divide and conquer Circe magic, stop reducing the world to good and bad guys. All we have to do is choose ecstasy over entertainment, write our own gospel and live our own myth. All we have to do is know ourselves. As the Valentinian Theodotus wrote, what makes us free is the gnosis of who we were, of what we have become, of where we were, of where rain we have been cast, of where to we are hastening, of what we are being freed from, of what birth really is, of what rebirth really is.
You want to understand the universe, embrace the universe. The door to the universe is you.
I will continue to help you every week on this show and the other aspects of the virtual Alexandria, like finding Hermes. And you help me so much with your assistance and feedback. I truly appreciate you. Oh, you that are so beautiful before they made you forget. Before they stopped letting you tell your story. Definitely check out the movie Talk Radio. Why Eric Bogosian and Oliver Stone are not more relevant just tells you what Hollywood is at its core. And why Jason and I never were able to sell our screenplays. And maybe that's a good thing. I know that the girls at the Red Scare podcast did a complete show last month on the film, so check more there. And hang in there during the holidays. The sun, the moon, and the stars, nature itself, as Jason said, is just fine, waiting for you to join in the light release of the Tikkun Olam, to awaken as you are eventually destined to. There are no movies in heaven. Nature doesn't need Hollywood or social media.
Yeah, and what if a woman competes with you in the marketplace and takes your job? And what if black men start dating and marrying white women? And what if homosexuals are teaching your children? And what if you're afraid to walk the streets at night? And what if you see yuppies getting rich while you're standing in the unemployment line? And what if your government sends you to Vietnam to fight a war they have no chance of winning? And what if your country is slipping away, lost? I know the argument, friend. It's the gripe theory of history. I've heard it before. It says when things ain't good, instead of getting down and doing something about it, instead of changing your life, it's a hell of a lot easier to blame somebody else. And it just don't wash in my book. There is no room for self-pity, sir, in my life
or
in yours.
Now, you ought to read the Turner Diaries, Barry, by William Pierce. Now, it's all there. See, it says...
Yes, yes, I'm familiar with that novel, A Product of the Enlightened
now,
Mind.
Now, see, the word America, Barry, means heavenly kingdom in the Gothic language.
Yeah.
It's the real New Jerusalem of Scripture, and it shows you how the Jews are imposters who took the
For those of you who don't know it, it starts idiotically enough in the year 1991.
That's
and
correct.
It's written as a diary by a young white racist electrical engineer who joins an underground paramilitary organization known as the Order.
That's right.
Oh, am I doing all right? Oh, great. Well, they institute a revolution against ZOG, the Zionist Occupied Government of America, and along the way they kill all the mongrel races, Jews, blacks, homosexuals, feminists, and other mud people. It's an idiotic book written for people with bubblegum brains who never got out of the fourth grade watching reruns of The Blob.
Easy, Barry. You're part of the problem, you see. You're another Jew, another weed-eating Jew in control of the media of this country, and from there you pass judgment on that which you don't know. And there will come a day for you, Barry. And thousands of others like you who have slept with black women, who have lied to us, when you'll hang from your neck with a placard around it saying, I betrayed my race.
This is the Aeon Bide interview. And with us, we have the pleasure of having back at the Virtual Alexandria, Jason Horsley, to discuss his new book, 16 Maps of Hell, The Unraveling of Hollywood Superculture. Jason, thanks for being here.
Hi, Miguel. Thanks for the invitation.
Pleasure is all mine, as always. As mentioned, I think our first interview was like 14 years or 13 years ago, and what a journey it's been. But wow. Always good to have you on.
Yeah, that long.
Yeah.
I was in Guatemala at the time.
Exactly. Yeah. And we certainly both believed in different things, and hopefully we've evolved.
Well, yeah, I'd be interested to hear how your beliefs have changed, because, yeah, mine have, as you know, they've been on quite a journey of deconstruction.
Yeah, I think mine probably have changed, maybe not as much. When we first talked, I was just getting started with the esoterica, the occult, the alternative, the conspiracy theory. So it's almost like I've been playing catch up. When I talked to you back then, you were already sort of ahead of the journey, if you would. You were thick in it.
Yeah, I was. I'm trying to come out now.
Exactly. So maybe I'm, what, few years behind you. But with us too, also joining us, we have the pleasure of having Nate. How are you, Nate?
Hey, Miguel, and thank you for inviting me to be on. And hello, Jason.
Hi, Nate.
Awesome. Well, let's get started. Jason, I guess the question is, tell us why you decided to write 16 Maps of Hell. I would probably say, obviously, I know the answer, and very much similar to the reasons you wrote Vice of Kings and Prisoner of Infinity, right? Your own exorcism, or as you write in your book, 16 Maps of Hell, is, of course, I caught the Jungian part, is the only way to exit hell is to integrate hell.
Yeah, well, that was in the last chapter, wasn't it? And even the last chapter I didn't have it. When I thought I'd finished the book, I realized I hadn't finished it. And so I was, as with previous books, I was really wrestling to get to grips with the subject that had possessed me to write the book. And that's the process of writing, is to somehow extricate myself from this personal compulsion to resolve something. By resolving it, and hopefully, finishing the book corresponds with the resolution, but I can never be too sure. With Vice of Kings, I really felt it didn't quite happen. Like, I couldn't actually finish the book to my satisfaction, which suggests that I wasn't really quite able to come to grips with the thing that I was trying to resolve with Vice of Kings, which really was that really centered in on my personal familial trauma. And so maybe with 16 Maps of Hell, I've taken a step back in a certain sense. I don't go so directly into my own personal trauma history, although I do go into my personal history, as you know. And I'm returning to Hollywood as well in movies, which the first book I ever published, Blood Poets, was about movies. And also the beginning of this latest series of books for me was Seen and Not Seen, where I was revisiting movies, back then, 6 years or so ago. So it's a bit, there's an Edgar Allan Poe quote that I've used a lot, which is the circle that returneth in ever to the self-same spot. Much of madness and more of sin and horror, the soul of the plot. That just popped into my mind there. But I was thinking the analogy of having to keep going back to a wound because it hasn't healed, right? And one tries to cover it up, but if it's infected or it hasn't been well dressed, it's not going to heal. So I have to keep undressing it and going back there. That seems to be what's happening here. And the question you asked, it struck me right away, the interesting kind of the structure of it, like what made me decide to write the book, because the answer is that I didn't decide. You know, I didn't really have a choice in it, not in the sense that there was some slave driver whipping me into it, but just that I wasn't aware of having decided to write this book. It had already started using me to write it, let's say, by the time I realized I had agreed. So, I mean, it did begin as a series of blog posts. So that was that. I mean, I definitely must have decided to do those blog posts about psychological operatives in Hollywood, as I called it. So that was a more superficial thing. And it usually begins, not the content per se, but I mean the project. It usually begins, Prisoner Infinity also began many years before I wrote the book, with what I thought was going to be a small article about Whitley Strieber. So it usually begins with just a kind of nagging interest or curiosity that I want to look at this a bit more closely in the case of the 16 Maps of Hell. I think the main thing, if I recall rightly, was this, and I definitely address this in the book, was this recurring cognitive dissonance that I was experiencing around the stories that were coming out about the entertainment industry, and my own research and deductions as well, about how destructive and abusive it was, with my own daily experience of the product, as in I really enjoy movies and TV shows, and I like there are certain actors and directors that I like and admire, and I couldn't reconcile these two things, and it kept bothering me, as cognitive dissonance does. I mean, that's the nature of it. We can't quite ignore it. So I just wanted to try and resolve it. And there was another element in there in that early series, which was that while on the one hand there was all this reinforcing of the mainstream Hollywood narrative that it was a creative place for artists and beautiful people, and you know, it was creating this wonderful product that we all enjoyed, there was this counter narrative becoming more and more prevalent about Hollywood Illuminati mind control and so on. Not mainstream, but the alternate mainstream of YouTube, for example. And that narrative was getting more and more insistent. And so that was creating a kind of third layer of cognitive dissonance, because I didn't really believe that either, even though I felt it was closer to the truth. I didn't feel like it was accurate in some way. So I just wanted to address that tangle of disinformation and propaganda of Hollywood with a kind of counter narrative that was supposedly exposing it, but wasn't doing a very good job, and it felt like it was, in a certain sense, I call it conspiratainment. It was almost like the entertainment industrial complex had co-opted conspiracy theory and was using it to rejuvenate its own products, while at the same time using the techniques of suspension of disbelief and infotainment to corrupt the conspiracy research field. So anyway, so I just, that was a superficial, it doesn't sound very superficial now, someday, but that was kind of the conscious way. I was like, let's look at this. But then sometime after I'd done the blog post, something compelled me, and I'm not sure what it was, to turn those blog posts into a book. And I just thought, well, that would be easy enough. I'll just add, you know, I'll cull the stuff I've written and haven't used and just flesh it out with a chapter here and a chapter there. And that was, you know, that was the naive me that forgot, you know, when I embark on a book, it's never simple, easy, or quick.
Yeah, it's certainly a journey when I read it. And I think you just hit on the idea of Hollywood being a psyop. And you write, the point of a psyop is not to keep it secret, but to have control over the narrative that emerges around it. The most affected psyop is the one that can persuade us. It is art, because we associate what moves us with art, and the art of propaganda is to move us illegitimately. And at the end of the day, I don't know Hollywood is a secret society, isn't it? I mean, it's got all the hallmarks of a secret society.
Well, it does if we understand what a secret... I mean, I think there are assumptions about secret societies again, and that this is part of the misinformation that is disguising itself as revelation, that secret societies themselves are secret, and they involve the rituals and the robes, and you know, there's a lot of tropes around what a secret society is, which might confuse us into either dismissing the idea that Hollywood's a secret society, because it's obviously not that, or apparently obviously, or into believing the wrong thing when we start to believe that it is a secret society. On the other hand, if we think of the Mafia as a better example of a secret society, although it isn't often referred to as that, or even the CIA for that matter, that a secret society isn't secret as a society, it's secret, it's a public society that has a secrets, you know, within it, and central to that secrecy is it poses as something else to what it is. So I mean, the Mafia is in that sense not such a great example, because everybody knows the Mafia is a criminal organization, but still they do all kind, they've got all kinds of fronts, and they do all kinds of legitimate businesses that are, you know, launder money. Well, they're not really legitimate, that's the point, but they appear legitimate and so on. So it's close enough. What else was I going to say there?
I think to understand what I like about your book is you try to couch things in a context. Again, as they've given us a narrative, you're trying to offer them a counter narrative, and you do this through many arguments. For example, you talk about, instead of calling something a secret society or a conspiracy theory, you switch it to social engineering. And that's, as you've written in Vice of Kings and others are pointing it out, social engineering is out there in the public. It's admitted. We have the think tanks. We've got the documentation that those on top want to change our society and manipulate our society so that we could have a certain narrative. And Hollywood is definitely a place where social engineering is legion, if you would.
Yeah, well, the same with the psychological operations. I mean, as I quote a number of manuals, military manuals for psychological operations, and obviously only the ones that have been declassified, and how overt and open and brazen those descriptions are, and how clearly they indicate the prevalence of psychological operations throughout culture. I mean, the focus usually is on foreign psychological operations, but that stands to reason that the domestic kind would be more classified. And how consistent they are, you know, the nature, the design, and the instruments of psychological operations, so consistent with Hollywood. It's quite striking. I mean, and this is my approach to this material, is to it's because I have a naturally conspiratorial mindset, so I don't have the knee-jerk reaction against conspiracy theory, unless it's this conspiratainment that I've touched upon, unless it's sensationalized and dumbed down, then I do have a adverse reaction. But to the idea that there might be groups who are manipulating us and society and have been for thousands of years, is not something that I ever had any difficulty with. So in a certain sense, I've chosen to try and recalibrate my approach with a more skeptical eye, because of being aware of how intelligent people dismiss things that I would say are true and are provably true, because of a knee-jerk reaction against them. But also other kinds of intelligent people, perhaps less intellectually oriented, believe prematurely. They believe things. They ingest facts embedded in a narrative, and the narrative itself has been shaped and constructed as a delivery device for the facts and as a way to maintain control of the narrative back to the psychological operation. So what I try to do with my recent books is just the facts, which isn't exactly true, because I do analyze and I do theorize, but my theories are more sociological and psychological. I'm not really doing conspiracy theory per se. I'm doing conspiracy fact, and then my theories are more about social analysis and human psychoanalysis. And I think one side effect of that, or it's actually a primary goal, a bit of both really, is that if you arrange the facts carefully enough around, for example, psychological operations in Hollywood, it becomes absolutely irrefutable, undeniable that this is going on, that there is a central conspiratorial element, covert operations, intelligence manipulations, want to call it anything but conspiracy, but basically that's what it is, right? Right. That's central to this, and you just see it. And I think that what I've found is that I know people, often academic-minded people, who are very skeptical about conspiracy theory and even dismiss it, but they don't dismiss what I do. But it's quite weird, because they might still think the conspiracy theory is nonsense, and yet they accept what they accept what I've presented. I don't know how that works exactly, but I think it's the power of evidence. You present the evidence carefully enough, and you don't necessarily have to go into the narratives that this is conspiracy, because the word's been co-opted. And, well, as you know, if you read my work, I'm always bringing it to complicity, which is we're all in on it, and that does change. That frame is a radical change of framing, I would say.
Yeah, I would certainly agree. And so much of your book was striking and sometimes intense for me. There's one section you're talking about Brian Hayden's work on secret society and sorcerers and how to control a culture. And Hollywood is nothing original. You talk about how Hayden tracks archaeologically through prehistory three ways of doing it. And they are: one, to spread terror through the populace. Well, that's Hollywood. To torture the women and steal their creative power. That's Alfred Hitchcock and his "We must torture women more," as you quote in the book plenty. And three, to use that power to create surrogate realities, dream matrices, artificial wombs, and attain virtual immortality. So Hollywood is just a continuation of the priest and the king trying to control the resources, the narrative, and rule well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, there's a methodology in it. It's going to appear in countless different forms, and Hollywood somehow strips bare the methodology and makes it very apparent and clear. So, yeah, in that sense, it's more and less than a conspiracy of individuals intending something. It's this way of shaping culture and society and directing it that's been with us for so long that we're products of it that we can't really recognize it anymore. And that's the challenge of writing a book like this. And it's the challenge that begins with me. I mean, back to this cognitive dissonance, how is it possible that intellectually I can deduce that Hollywood and its products are toxic, while at a more visceral level, I still keep going back to them to enjoy them? Well, because I'm kind of made out of them. It's like in the womb, my mother was an alcoholic. My whole physiological being was formed out of those toxins partly. So actually extricating myself from that matrix of control, it's going to require a lot more than any kind of intellectual deduction and reasoning. It requires an internal I don't want to say revolution, because revolutions go nowhere, don't they? But yeah. The equivalent, a true revolution, like a transformation. And until that happens, it's like the fish in the water. Right? It can hear rumors about this thing called water, but it just doesn't get it because it's just never known anything besides water.
Yeah, oh, I would certainly agree. I mean, I pretty much watch a tenth of the movies and shows that I used to, same discovery as you, Jason. Mm-hmm. I still feel it's too much, and I feel I love getting into this content. Like you said, it really is part of our DNA, and I think you even write, you would probably still sell a screenplay to Hollywood, wouldn't you? I know I would.
Well, I'd take the money, sure. Exactly. But I'd also get excited about the thought that I was going to work with, this actor or that director. I couldn't not. I mean, I might say no. I might have the sense to not get pulled into it now. But certainly my, decades of conditioning, I couldn't help but respond like Pavlov's dog and start to salivate. So.
Yeah. It's quite
it's sobering.
It is sobering, but at least you know. And also too, working on, speaking of Hayden again, he writes about how even in ancient times they found children footsteps into the caves of shamans. So is this sort of terrorizing children and maybe feeding off of their essence, something that has just been going on for centuries and Hollywood really has maximized or weaponized for their power, their whatever you want to call it, satanic force?
Well, I mean, of course, I don't know, what went on in the past. We've got some sort of record, and then a lot of it's deductive. But there's a number of ways in which I see a correlation between trauma and child abuse and fantasy creation, to the extent that, we create an entertainment media that itself is re-traumatizing, even though paradoxically it's a way to escape from it. So this is the thing that I've been trying to unravel in my own psyche in terms of which I write about and seen and not seen, the ways in which my own predilection for Hollywood media, including really dark, violent, sort of video nasty stuff at the more extreme end, was evidence that I failed to spot for many years of trauma in my own psyche. And so looking at that very specific, very personal internal landscape, charred earth, and then noticing how closely it corresponded with what you're referring to here and what I refer to, which is the bigger picture stuff of human manipulation of society and of groups and of individuals and corruption and exploitation that's throughout history and prehistory, even. Like, we've got the sense of that, and of course we've got a huge moral indignation in the world now with social justice warriors and all that, decrying the patriarchy. So there's this historically confirmed or established awareness that we've always been in this exploitative human system that includes, although this doesn't get talked about so much by social justice warriors at all, but includes or centers around child abuse and even child sacrifice is something that we kind of associate with ancient primitive history. It's in the Bible and whatnot, prehistory even. But I think it continues. I mean, the sort of bald, stark answer can end up like Alex Jones ranting about Hillary Clinton eating babies, or these neon nettle articles, which are all fake about, Keanu Reeves says that Hollywood elite live on baby's blood. These things actually may be true, is the worst of it, but we don't know. And it probably doesn't help to, definitely doesn't help to prematurely go there. because it is so sensationalist and it's so shocking that either we're going to shut down and withdraw, or worse, we'll just kind of get into the superficial aspect and be titillated by this idea. But what I was trying to get to, I think, was that not separately, but congruent, consistent with the possibility that actual child sacrifice is something that is, continues to this day and is central. And certainly we know that organized child abuse continues to this day. I mean, there's indisputable evidence of that. It's been the backbone of our culture and our society, I think, since the beginning. That's such a huge thing to try and come to terms with, that what I try and bring it down to is our direct experiential experience of this, which has to do obviously with our own parenting and our own childhood, and in this context, our own relation to culture and its products, and how there's an element of abuse even in this, like the kind of entertainment media that parents give their children. I mean, now they're giving their infants smartphones, for example. Well, that's not necessarily exposing those infants to violent media, although they might watch Disney, and we kind of know that Disney is pretty sinister and has subliminal imagery and stuff. So we could go there if we wanted. I think you and I have even talked about that subject. But I mean, even just putting a kid in front of a TV set at the age of one, or giving an infant a smartphone, even that's a form of abuse. So it's a really wide spectrum. And again, it's become so integral to the culture that we don't see it unless it gets magnified into something that might be so horrifying that it seems absurd to us. But I honestly think that that stuff that you touched on, the secret societies and the child sacrifice and the child abuse that's ritualized and so on, that stuff, it's also real, and it's what it looks like if we really draw aside the veil that we've pulled over our own eyes in order not to see that. And yet the veil itself is showing us also, as I say, it's just much more subtle, the ways in which we are complicit with child abuse and child sacrifice.
Yeah, and it's been going on since the dawn of time. I like how you write, filmmaking is sorcery, the modern technological development of an ancient art. And of course, you write about filmmakers like Polanski and Hitchcock perhaps weren't interested in the occult or magic or shamanism, but they were interested in the effects on their audience, and they knew they could sort of weaponize it to get the effects. And huge part of it was trauma inducing, again, going to Hayden's number one, to spread terror through the populace. And you tie it in very well with the legacy of Carlos Castañeda's old seers, dreaming to shape the real world. So this is what these individuals were doing. And of course, it's a perfect opportunity for other more materialistic agencies like the mob, military, corporations to use this magic or to leverage this magic with these sorcerers like Polanski and Hitchcock or Kubrick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was a surprise to me, actually. And it's one of the odd things about seeing something more clearly, is that, like, I could maybe 30 years ago, I could have written something similar, that filmmaking is just the modern technological development of ancient sorcery. As a concept, it's not that radical or strange or new, but somehow, because I came to it as if for the first time through all of these discoveries I was making, it did land in a way that was shocking to me. And that itself is significant, because it's not the same to intellectually formulate something as to really see it. And it does, it turns everything kind of upside down, as I tried to do in that chapter, in that summing up, or that reaching this insight that, for example, that the idea that Hollywood filmmakers might be secretly sorcerers, practicing sorcery, somehow never added up for me. But when I started to consider the possibility that there might be sorcerers working behind the scenes, which is something I always felt was probably true, and, well, maybe they might actually go to Hollywood and want to use film as one of their techniques and tools, that just seemed to make perfect sense. And it's the same thing, just seen from a different angle. But having said that, even there, I think one doesn't necessarily have to go there, because even there, that's difficult for the rational mind to really believe, because the essence of sorcery is perception management. And like the magician's sleight of hand, the main thing is to make sure that we don't see what we're not supposed to see, and if we do, we don't believe it, and that we believe the thing that we're supposed to believe. That's the whole sleight of hand thing. So that was partly why I ended up focusing on Polanski for 16 Maps of Hell, because I realized that I needed to have a much more specific focus, and even a protagonist in the book, and to really test how difficult it is to pull aside the veil of preconception we might have about the world or individuals within it, in this case, you know, a big Hollywood filmmaker, and allow ourselves to see that they might not be remotely what they seem to be. And obviously I can't prove that Polanski is, you know, anything but what he appears. All I can do is just keep piling up all the evidence that he isn't what he appears to be. And somehow that's the essence of sorcery, is that it casts a spell over us so that we can only see the reality that we're supposed to see. We can only believe in the narrative that we've been given. We can't imagine there's another narrative outside of that. And we can't divorce us, we can't separate, we can't take our eyes off the screen, so to speak. So it's like we have to start imagining another narrative that's the opposite of the one we're caught up in, and then looking at the evidence more closely, and then moving the evidence over to this new narrative, and just see, or at least putting it close enough to see if it gets pulled into it. That's what I tried to do with Polanski. Just keep piling up the evidence and see if it would, like iron filings to a magnet, see if it would start getting pulled into the counter narrative that Polanski was something entirely different, you know, a part of an organized criminal intelligence operation, possibly with sorcerous, you know, kind of elements to it. How well the evidence just naturally meshed with and therefore informed that new narrative. And then the old narrative starts to wobble and dissolve. And that, as I said, that's very personal for me, because Polanski is almost like a family member. And that's presumably what I'm trying to recreate here is probably early childhood experiences of family members who weren't what they appeared to be, but it was impossible to confront that, and at a certain point it was impossible to even see that, because all the pressure was to go along with the false narrative and submit to it, because otherwise life would be unbearable. Polanski became a kind of surrogate identification figure for me in my adolescence. Clint Eastwood was another, and so I got colonized by Polanski and the idea that he's a good guy, a great filmmaker and a good guy. I kind of loved him in this parasocial way. So that was helpful for me to bring it down to one single parasocial relationship that was more closely equivalent to, as I say, a family member or somebody actually in my life, where the deception, the self-deception was essential to my survival. That's essentially how we get co-opted, I think, as we have to invest in a false narrative in order to survive.
Oh, definitely so. I mean, like you, Polanski, my mom would say his name in awe because he was, well, he was also, as you write, he represented what's best in Europe, but he was also edgy, and he was a person of awe. But the narrative, too, is also very important. I feel that the Cielo Drive murders was sort of a lifting of the veil for those of us who were sensitive or alternative researchers of what Hollywood really was. And as you write that, even that narrative got co-opted too. But your book, you said, well, you really weren't going to write about it, the Manson murders, but you felt you had to. And I feel because you really had to, again, reoriented that narrative we were given.
Yeah. And that's strange. Again, it's a strange example of what I'm trying to talk around here, which is that I didn't want to write about Manson, and I didn't think it was central to my book. but I just did, in the end, consciously decide, well, there should be something about him in there, and also about that period of the 70s in Hollywood. And I just felt it was a missing piece. And as you know, as you're saying, the missing piece became the strongest material in the book, which then led to me putting it at the very front of the book. And then that led me to realizing, wait, no, actually, this is the central narrative of the book. This is the case study in terms of these false narratives. And yeah, the Manson thing, of course, for me, it was always... it took me a long time to see it the way that you described it, and the way that I see it in 60 Maps of Hell as an unveiling of Hollywood culture. To me, for years, it was a glimpse into psychological operations, intelligence manipulations. Like I almost, it feels like I always felt there was something fishy about the Manson case. And I simplified that and even maybe dumbed it down in my early book, The Lucid View, to, you know, Manson, Charles Manson, CM, was a Manchurian candidate, MC. He was controlled. He was a puppet of the intelligence community in order to, so for social engineering purposes, and that, there was a mirroring of the Manson murders with Rosemary's Baby and whatever was going on with Polanski. So in my first book, pre-Lucid View, The Blood Purse, I wrote about the Manson murders. It's like they pop up consistently through my work, all the way to this latest one. But this latest one was the first time I began to look at Hollywood as... or the Manson murders is something that revealed the nature of Hollywood, as you put it. And that unfolded through the process of revisiting it for 16 Maps of Hell, how acutely, how clearly that I was able to see that. And, you know, I sort of summed it up, and it's on the cover of the book now. There's images of Manson and Polanski mirroring each other, and then there's a quote from Charles Manson. I might as well read it as long as we're on it. He said, "The real Humphrey Bogart and the real James Cagney are actors. I mean the ones you know. The real ones, they died in here. In other words, we die so you guys can play actors. We got to be the bad guys so you guys can be the good guys. But in reality, we know that you're not the good guys, that you guys are worse than we are." So that's
the one quote I wrote down on my notes too, Jason.
Wow. Oh, is it? that flipped things over. I mean, not that he said that, but I quote it because what I started to see was flipping things over, that Manson was becoming more sympathetic and more self-aware and more honest, I guess is the point. While Polanski was becoming increasingly fitting the profile of what we're told about Manson. And, you know, this shadowy, corrupt, sadistic, vicious mind control, manipulating perception behind the scenes, and, you know, becoming this messianic cult leader. That idea we have about Manson fits someone like Polanski better, or at least fits the evidence around someone like Polanski better than Manson. So that flipping of the narrative, I think, is central to how we get, you know, we get our perceptions hijacked and hoodwinked.
Yeah, because even the whole story has it all: the occult, the intelligence, influence, the mafia, the drug dealing. I mean, it really does have everything. It exposes everything, and it's not unique to Hollywood. But even then, as I said, the narrative got flipped even with something like that, even if it was staring at us. Because, like, I don't know about you, but I did read Vincent Bugliosi's book many years ago, and I thought Helter Skelter was like the Bible of the narrative. And as you point out, that was just another way of another sorcery to get our attention somewhere else.
Yeah, well, it's interesting now because the main thing with Helter Skelter was the race war, that Manson was trying to create a race war. And that's just interesting in today's context because somebody sure as hell is trying to create a race war in the US.
Yeah.
Right? So it probably has been a project for many decades, or at least that's possibly, I shouldn't say probably, but it seems the evidence suggests. So there are so many layers to the Manson onion, aren't there? Because it does seem as though it was a continuation of an ongoing psychological operation that is decades long. I mean, it gets passed on from one head of the CIA to the next, not that it's just the CIA. And then somebody like Manson pops up as this player in this grand theater that he himself has very little awareness about, and he expressed that, like, he got turned into the boogeyman, and he cooperated, he played the role of the boogeyman, even while at the same time he was saying he was innocent. But nobody even believed or listened to that because that was absurd. You know, the idea and the image of Manson as ultimate evil is so strong. I mean, that's an example of Hollywood and the overlap between the news media and Hollywood. The way that Manson was on the cover of Life magazine with the staring eyes, and just, you know, the whole Manson persona is so much like a Hollywood creation. And I think Manson did cooperate with it, but at the same time, he was stating, as I discover in the book, he made some clear statements that probably did point to closer to what was really going on, so far as he could understand it. Let's just say it was part of such a huge operation that I don't suppose any single player understood it. But anyway, I mean, my interest from the start and to date seems to center around the weird parallels between the Manson murders as they were officially reported and I shouldn't call them the Manson murders, the Tex Watson murders that Manson was blamed for, let's say, and Rosemary's Baby, and how that was Polanski's into Hollywood. There seems to be a really archetypal thing there about sacrificing the child and to make a deal with the devil in order to attain success in the world. That's such an ancient archetypal story, and I think Polanski is really at the heart, well, obviously he was at the heart of his own story, but it was quite explicit with him. Like, he made the movie about it. It made him successful. Then he lost his child and his wife. Right? And then we had the whole Manson narrative around that, which was about Satanism and all the rest of it. And the mainstream media did connect the two, but in this very shoddy way that was easy to dismiss as just yellow journalism. But as I tried to get in the book, with some deeper analysis, there are clear indications of a psychological operation there, I would say, that included Rosemary's Baby as an artifact within it.
Yeah, you do a great job showing us this. And it's, again, it's not just Polanski, but all these directors and movers and shakers. I mean, Hollywood is this nexus of, I keep repeating, intelligence, mafia, occultism, just everything there, I guess, because this is the place where you can control the narrative. And another movie you talk about too, Jason, and I wanted to address, and that's The Exorcist. And I think I always felt, or as someone said, The Exorcist is really like, you might say, Hollywood's first blockbuster. It kind of changed the game. People were coming in droves to sit there, and it set the stage for all Hollywood blockbusters. But at the end of the day, this is also one of the most powerful psyops about child abuse and the occult and everything else. Don't you agree?
Yeah. It's a movie I never liked, actually, which makes it easier for me to see and deconstruct. Because, as you know, I mean, my early writing about film was as a film lover. And so I still have that strong in me. And it's the thing I'm trying to override, because it sabotages my judgment when it comes to these deeper dives. But with The Exorcist, I never fell for it. I always felt there was something really manipulative about it. So it's interesting to revisit it in this regard and keep finding more reasons to dislike it. While in the meantime, it's being constantly rarefied. I just saw yesterday that there's a documentary coming out, I think it's on Netflix, another one about William Friedkin and The Exorcist. This one, the whole documentary, full-length documentary, is dedicated to the movie and what a genius Friedkin is. I forget what it's called, but I know the focus is on faith. And Friedkin is now, I mean, he has been for a long time, actually, but again, he's still pushing The Exorcist as this masterpiece that he made that's all about the mystery of faith, which I frankly think is utterly ridiculous. I think it's kind of an example of Hitler's big lie somehow. Yeah. People, whatever, I mean, I guess the movie has a following, and when people are enthralled to a movie, they want to believe that they're justified in their worship of it and their allegiance to it. So if you can somehow instill it with this numinous quality that it's actually this great work that explores the human condition. I mean, no, to give Spielberg some credit, I'd never want to give Spielberg credit. Nobody's tried to do that for Jaws, you know, and I still love Jaws to this day, but nobody's tried to present Jaws as some kind of, even as a masterpiece, really. It's just recognized as a wonderfully entertaining movie that was, you know, kind of unprecedented in the skill for entertaining that movie had. And see, I'm not going to defend Spielberg or anything like that, but just as a counterpoint, that somehow The Exorcist, central to its endurance, is that there's this constant insistence that it's not only a masterpiece, which it's about something deep and profound, and that even it's benign, you know, that it's got this benign function. So I would say that almost confirms my how much I reveal and see about the nature of The Exorcist in the book as a very quite overt case of a film that's designed in order to manipulate and to subtly traumatize audiences with and deliver a specific narrative. I mean, obviously there's the narrative of the movie, but I mean a narrative in the sense of, the reality of the devil, perhaps, although this is where it gets really confusing and I don't resolve this in the book. The use of fear in the occult, you know, is it cynical, or is it by practitioners of it? And are we supposed to believe in it to be terrorized, or are we supposed to disbelieve in it so that it can better manipulate us? I think a movie like The Exorcist kind of has it both ways. I think it appeals to the the atavistic part of us, you could say the child infant part, but also the atavistic in the sense, you know, the primitive superstitious part of us. And we get terrified, while at the same time, the intellectual part can dismiss it all as a fantasy about Satan. We don't have to believe in the devil to be scared by the Exorcist, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. Where the faith comes in, I don't know. I mean, I haven't yet heard any evidence that anyone has had their faith deepened by the Exorcist. apparently, that's what Friedkin is claiming.
But it also has all the hallmarks, like, again, Polanski and Rosemary's Baby and the Manson thing. I mean, you've got William P. Blatty, who was a Jesuit and an intelligence guy. You talk about how I didn't know this, but one, I think a technician or a doctor in the movie was actually a serial killer in real life afterwards.
Bateson, yeah, Bateson. Paul Bateson, yeah.
So yeah. It's all this weirdness around it.
Yeah. Well, I'm hesitant about getting into the minutiae because it fills up a whole chapter and there's so much. Devil is in the details, as they say. There's so many details around the Exorcist and Friedkin and Peter Blatty that I would say, for me at least, with possible exception of Leonard Cohen in the book, it's the most compelling case that I make that certain players and products in Hollywood are 100% pure uncut intelligence operations with the organized crime in there too. And so I refer to it myself, like when I'm in this cognitive dissonance, I remind myself the Exorcist, Peter Blatty, William Friedkin, it just seems indisputable to me. And it's at the various different levels. One can look into the backstory of Friedkin and Blatty. There's ample evidence there. One can look at the artifact itself, the product, the Exorcist, the subliminals, the effects it's had on audiences. And then one can look at Friedkin's own autobiography, the things he points out, his relationship with Jolly West, the thing with Paul Bateson, those weird overlaps with Paul Bateson being cast in The Exorcist because he worked at the clinic in New York and then later being charged with the bag murders because of his connection to that hospital, the neuro clinic, I forget the exact word, but while simultaneously Jolly West was working in the equivalent West Coast clinic in California, while he had this relationship with Friedkin, Friedkin making the movie Cruising, which is about the murders of homosexuals. Anyway, as I say, I can't sum up all the details because it's complex, but it's very persuasive for me as a skeptical author, and I am. I'm skeptical of my own arguments because of what I say. You know, I've got a lifetime believing that I never thought Friedkin was a great filmmaker, so he's not like Polanski for me. But still, I like the French Connection, and I've got this context that Friedkin was, just a part of the 70s cinema that I love so much, and it the whole house of cards starts to wobble if one of those cards can be more or less established as a working intelligence operative who's doing something very different from simply making movies, even though a movie is central to what he's doing. See what I mean? There's a different end. It's not entertainment, it's not money, it's not status, it's not fame, certainly not art, but Friedkin never claimed to be an artist, on the contrary. right? It's psychological manipulation.
Yes, it's as we go back to sorcery, shifting reality, becoming godlike. I mean, as I think you're right, every artist is a recovering psychopath. As artists, isn't that what we want, Jason? We want control over reality.
Well, I'd say we all do, actually, Miguel. And maybe, I mean, there's a trope that, a bad childhood leads to a good artist, that kind of trope. And probably the part of that mechanism is that when we're to the extent that we're traumatized as children and put in these terrible conditions where we're powerless, the more unconsciously driven we'll be later in life to control our circumstances, our environment, our reality, and become powerful to just to try and block out that awful formative experience and unconsciously try to heal it, even though it doesn't work, of course, that way. And so being an artist is, well, there's a number of ways in which you could see that that would meet that need to have control. One is that the artistic process itself is a way of shaping realities. Even, you know, writing, I can have total control over how I edit it. Movie making takes it to the next level, where you're controlling individuals, you're creating sets and objects. You know, it's almost total control. It's the equivalent of almost literally shaping your environment. And then the other thing is, of course, is that in our culture, to be an artist, to be a successful artist is very high status. It's practically the highest status, which is I touched on in the outtake about David Lynch, at least, that we worship artists like gods. And so if we want to be a god, then probably the one of the surest routes to that, and certainly the one I chose, would be to be a successful artist.
Well said. And Nate, do you have a question for Jason?
Sure. Great. So there's two words that you brought up that I would love it if you would just explain to the audience quickly. Menticide and schismogenesis or schismogenesis?
Yeah, schismogenesis. That one's from Gregory Bates, and who's very well respected. I have associates and friends who defend him and get a bit upset that I include him in these dark conspiratorial agendas. But as far as I can see, he was pretty complicit anyway, and he coined the term schismogenesis, but not just as a neutral anthropological observer, but as a member of the OSS, you know, as a field operative who was designing or formulating strategies and methods for psychological control of populations. So schismogenesis, and we're in a time of it now, so it's a good topic. I mean, it's a good thing. We can observe it and understand it by observing it, but it has to do with, well, it's divide and conquer with a fancy name, but there's more to it as well. It has to do with polarizing populations in a way that, and this relates to narrative control as well. So, I mean, I suppose a good, an easy example now would be the U.S. election.
Exactly, exactly.
this, and then more and more seeing that if you're not with us, you're against this kind of reasoning. That, and even the thing around COVID, that you're, if you don't wear a mask now, you're a Trump supporter, for example. I don't know if you've heard this kind of, that this happens in the ideological kind of madness that's sweeping people now, that you get pushed into one camp or another. There's this increased polarization, and so you can't be in the middle. You have to align yourself with one side or another, and if you don't, you'll just get pushed in or sucked in by the gravitational pull. And it accumulates, because if you, the more that you reinforce narrative and counter-narrative, obviously the stronger they get, the more they pull people into them, but also the more people get pulled into them, then the stronger those narratives become, because they got more and more voices. And we experience it. I mean, what Bateson was looking at, observing and then weaponizing, was something that everybody knows, really, the doubling down thing. So, you know, if somebody has a strong opinion that you disagree with, you tend to strengthen your own opinion about something in order to resist it. If someone is in a marriage, for example, if your partner is being surly and unfriendly, you start being surly back. You don't want to just be open and loving and offer love in case they're going to reject it. So you're waiting to see if you'll get the opening and the confirmation from the other. And if you don't, you're going to push further into your own corner. This kind of doubling down response we have in order to not be overwhelmed by the influence of the other is something that's just, I think it's universal. So Bateson, he mapped it and he turned it into a method and a policy and so on. And we've been talking about it today, actually, like when I say about the way that there's a split and a polarization around Hollywood. Either it's this dark mind control Illuminati thing, or it's just Hollywood. It's entertainment, and neither is true.
I wanted to mention we were talking about menticides. I think I'm saying it wrong too, but one of your central ideas you propose is that of turning us into latas. And of course, you keep bringing up the famous, you're right, this brings us full circle and back to Stalin's chicken, the famous example that they can just terrorize us, but we'll keep coming back for more. And to turn us, and the latas is to, the idea is to turn us into a trance-like state of cultural possession in which they will obey commands without ever realizing we are doing so. And I think it's obvious this is what Hollywood is doing. It's turning us into latas.
Yeah, well, that's I could talk more about Lata than menticide, because I think menticide was just a term I plucked from somewhere and tossed it in there without really unpacking it. So I'm not even sure who it came from, although it's self-explanatory, the murder of the mind. Lata is something that I discovered, actually my wife discovered, because she does most of my research. And I thought it was fascinating. And actually, William Burroughs wrote about Lata. So it's not like it was completely unheard of, but I think very, very few people have heard the phrase. And I think it was in Malaysia, but correct me if I'm wrong if you remember. But anyway, these the cases of so-called Lata, of individuals who inexplicably enter into a trance state and just obey commands. It's like what we think of the hypnotic trance state that can be induced. There's this condition that seems to occur spontaneously. That relates to cultural possession, cultural bondage. So that was super useful to me as an alternate angle or lens through which to look at something that is being manipulated and is being induced and that is actually quite prevalent. Like there are a number of ways in which we allow our culture to possess us and to tell us what to do and obey commands without thinking. And of course, we're living in a time that's a very topical subject, isn't it? Because we're culturally bonded now to the COVID-19 narrative and obeying commands in a trance-like state, often without knowing why. Actually, I mean, you can, like I, a number of people I see wearing a mask one day and not the other, and I ask them, "Well, why are you wearing the mask today and not yesterday?" And they don't know, not really. I think because they don't want to wear the mask, but they feel they have to. And then, of course, if you ask them why they feel they have to, then they've got something they will say, but it's not coming from them. They're repeating something that they've heard.
Yeah, very much like I'm thinking the idea of egregores and tulpas, how we create these energies, these thought forms that can take over the whole culture. And I, for some reason, that's what I related to when talking about latas. And again, this goes right back to Hollywood, and it's no conspiracy because it's obvious, even with the sorcery thing, Jason. hasn't Disney been telling us for years that we create magic, we cast spells on our audience? I mean, it's hidden in plain sight.
Yeah. Well, true enough. And of course, the Harry Potter thing has now come all the way, you know, all the way out of the closet that sorcery is cool. So, that's one of the things I try to address in the last part of the book, in terms of there seems to be something about I call it the cryptocracy's coming out party, that, and also I think I call it the thing William Burroughs talks about, that in this process of cultural possession, the conscious agents that are implementing the takeover, let's say, the gatekeepers, those who've consciously and voluntarily given up their souls to the culture or to AI or whatever we're going to call that, to become instruments of it. Christians, of course, would call it something else. They need to reshape the culture to such an extent that we allow ourselves to get taken over and we begin to embody it also. And at the point that enough people have been taken over, then there's no need for any deception or concealment anymore. We can just be openly participating in this transhumanist madness, the disembodiment fantasy of child abuse and women torture or whatever it is, the normalization of insanity, I suppose. I mean, I'm aware I don't want to get too sensationalistic here, but there does seem to be a way in which we're becoming more openly complicit with something. And I think it's creating an enormous amount of tension because it's irreconcilable. So on the one hand, there's more and more moral outrage about the terrible things that the patriarchs are doing to us and the planet. And on the other hand, there's more and more conscious and willing complicity with it. Like we're becoming more and more consciously yeah. instruments of it. And so that can't sustain itself. It's there with identity politics as well. These profound inherent contradictions that are becoming more and more dynamic as the polarization increases. It seems to be nearing a critical point, which is just that society becomes, this is what Girard writes about with mimetic violence. It's just like a match is struck and the whole thing catches flame, which is why I'm thinking of heading out of society entirely.
I
doesn't seem a good time to be part of the human race, and I'm not suggesting we can cut off internally, but in terms of actually participating in the ideological madness and the latter cultural possession, it is getting more and more fraught, and I think it's also correspondingly more and more volatile.
Oh, I would definitely agree. But again, taking that inward journey, as you say, and integrating those hells is what works. But someone I wanted to talk about, and that is Leonard Cohen. And I've always said something I've always liked about the Gnostic aesthetic is that your heroes must become villains and your villains must become heroes. It's almost part of it. And you must, as we've done, you must go home many times. So of course, you write about how you enjoyed Cohen's music. And I've been very influenced by Cohen. But when was the first time, as they say, you started smelling a rat?
It would have been Anne Diamond, speaking to Anne Diamond. I'm pretty sure it came quite unexpectedly, unless I'm forgetting something. Because when I spoke to Anne Diamond, who knew Cohen, well, by as far as she's aware, you know, based on fragmented memories, even as a very small child, she had some contact with him, but certainly at a more conscious linear time frame, she knew him in her early 20s, I think, and was Cohen's lover for a time, and just an on and off friend. And anyway, I spoke to her in the early days of the Liminalist. It's Liminalist number 31. I Know Who You Are, I think it's called. And it was like a 4 or 5 hour conversation that we had, in which she recounted her memories of Cohen and her own experiences with MK Ultra, or what seemed to be the Canadian wing of it. It was Ewan Cameron, etc. And the overlaps there and her own deductions about Cohen's involvement in similar, or in the same, rather, in the exact same programs. And again, you know, there's a number of ways in which I then approached that revelation or tried to verify it. A number of different bodies of evidence, the main one really being Cohen's own output, as I did with Whitley Strieber and Prisoner Infinity. Let's just go to the horse's mouth and see what's in it. And you know, the things Cohen himself said and communicated through his work, once it's put in this context of Anne Diamond's testimony, really just transformed, and I just became overwhelmed by the evidence. And it was a bit confusing in more ways than one, because actually, Cohen seems to be confessing a lot of what he was doing, and that suggested a desire to repent. That suggested that there was some deep awareness in there, and you could say it makes the song, well, it does make the songs more interesting, of course. They're more revealing if one sees what they're actually revealing, and it's remarkable what they seem to be revealing, which is that Cohen was this lifetime actor who was working for shadowy forces, and that his output and his success as a folk singer was central to that role that he had in socio-cultural engineering, and that he was somewhat ambivalent about it and therefore wanted to come clean. His last words, you know, as an artist, his last album, which I think came out even after he died, yeah, it did, The Hummingbird, which is a code word for an intelligence operative who poses as an artist, roughly. I might be slightly simplifying that, but it's in the book anyway. And the last word of that song, The Hummingbird, are, "Don't listen to what I say." So I think his whole output was a veiled confession. And as I say, that sort of compromises how compromised he was, if you see what I mean. That means at least he was trying to come clean. But it's still, I mean, I don't listen to Cohen anymore, not as a, like, I never will kind of thing. I just don't have his music on my hard drive anymore because of this. Even though I'm aware that probably if I deep dived into any of the other artists I liked, I might find enough evidence to not want to listen to them. So I'm not saying that because I think it's a necessary thing for me. Just that it was compelling enough for me with Cohen that I just thought, well, why listen to the guy at this point? Because it's so sticky and messy, and I can't trust my responses, I think is the point I wanted to get to an end on. This poet, and I didn't address it before because I thought it was a really good one that you took from the book, that the art and psyop, what they have in common is persuasion and moving us emotionally and in other ways. And the question is it legitimate or not? Now, art, if there is such a thing, would be a legitimate persuasion. Psychological operation is illegitimate, but I don't feel qualified to tell the difference anymore, particularly. I mean, the closest I'd come to trying to is checking the source. You know, who is this person who's creating the art, and where are they coming from? And that might help me to gauge the art itself. But in terms of how I respond to the product, the better a sourcer is at manipulating our responses, the less equipped or less able we would be to tell how legitimate that was, or to rather to tell that it was illegitimate. We would just think we were being persuaded by art, you know, by beauty, by truth.
And just on a side question, do you still listen to David Bowie?
Well, actually, Miguel, I don't hardly listen to mainstream music at all because I just, for the podcast, The Liminalist, I had to dig so deep on the internet to find music that wasn't copyrighted that nobody had heard of, that I've got a huge reserve of these songs by people that maybe that no one's heard of, or there's some bands that are just less well known, like Rose Windows.
On your podcast, I always enjoy the music interludes. Yeah, somebody I've never heard of most of the time.
Well, that's my goal for sure. So I just kind of got rid of most of my mainstream music. There's still Talking Heads on there. There's a bunch, like Mumford and Sons just popped into mind. The Kills, there are. So it's, but in terms of Bowie, the reason I don't listen to Bowie now is because I've heard him too damn much. I mean, I grew up on that stuff, so it doesn't really have any surprises for me. But I still like Bowie for sure. I still like those early songs.
But with Cohen, it is interesting because, as you write, he always seems to be at the right time at the right place for his career to really explode. And I had no idea, but he was also at the Bay of Pigs and he was arrested as a spy. I mean, that should have given it all away right there. Who gets arrested at the Bay of Pigs?
Well, yes and no. I mean, because he had an exotic life and this bohemian thing, and actually, you know, of course, the life of an artist, an avant-garde kind of artist or cutting-edge artist, and an activist and a political operative, you can see there's a continuum there. So a lot of the stuff he was doing, traveling around, and then when he was on Hydra and Greek Island, and it superficially it seems like the life of a radical bohemian kind of artist. So again, it's what's your context. So I did know some of those things before, but like he called his band the Army and they ended with the military salute. Well, that doesn't seem like anything unless you put it in the, I mean, it seems like irony, I should say. It seems like, well, that's irony, isn't it? But if you put in, you start looking at these other things, like he supported Ronald Reagan and more police on the streets and was part of the Israeli Defense Force and so on. Well, okay, so the army thing wasn't irony. It was what can't be concealed should be actively displayed policy. Like he put it front and center like Jimmy Savile, and people will think it's just a joke.
Do you think he was a follower of Sabbatai Zevi, or what's the evidence on that one?
That came from Anne Diamond, and I'm just not qualified to say. I included it in there because there's an interesting data point, and that's a very interesting sect, isn't it? And they do pop up. I mean, the name pops up, and it popped up in relation to Harvey Weinstein. So that was another reason to include it in there.
Oh, Weinstein was connected too? I didn't know.
There was the article about Weinstein that referred to it. Not, I don't think it was that Weinstein himself made any claims, but I just remember that there was a key article about Weinstein that I quoted in the book about Harvey Weinstein basically claiming he was a martyr. Yeah. He was a martyr to women's rights, whatever. In other words, you know, what he'd done, all he'd done in order to raise awareness about the exploitation of women. And the article was about, well, that's the defense that, you know, that could certainly be useful to some predators out there. And Jimmy Savile and Hitler could claim that he was, you know, raising awareness for anti-Semitism and so on. And so that pertains to the cult of Sabbatai Zevi, which is to do with the Antichrist being the true Messiah, and how the immortalization of the eschaton, I suppose. I'm not sure, I'm winging it a bit now, but in terms of you want to bring about the second coming, the revelation, then you got to do lots of evil things in order to facilitate it, which was, I think, was Crowley's MO and his justification. So yeah, the greatest sinner is the greatest, is a self-sacrifice, and therefore is a martyr, and therefore is the greatest saint. I'm not saying I believe this, by the way, just that.
No, of course.
That would be where something like the cult of Sabbatai Zvi would come in, and Cohen, yeah, I mean, he certainly was a deep thinker, and he was deep into stuff, and he was deeply connected, and his music is full of esoteric stuff and so on. You know, it's just kind of at a certain point, if it quacks like a duck and it floats like a duck and so on, my tendency is to just say, well, yeah, probably, but that's all it is. It's a guess.
Yeah, or at least, like, again, we go back to Polanski and Hitchcock. They knew this stuff works, this ancient sorcery, these archetypal energies. So they would just run with it. And speaking of, again, we brought up Weinstein, and obviously we've talked about COVID and all that. Do you feel that the whole this, that we're going through a shift, and maybe Hollywood is on its heels, maybe even its death throes, that I would definitely root for Hollywood not coming back. I don't want to see another superhero movie ever. I admit that. I guess my kids would be very sad. But what do you think? You think Hollywood's in trouble?
Well, I've been wondering, you know, for personal reasons, like, the next season of Succession, you know, is that going to get made? Because I'm really looking forward to it, right? So I've been keeping my eye on that in terms of how much they're actually having to shut down production in order to comply with the narrative and, you know, be consistent with it, even if insiders don't believe it. So that's one thing. You know, superficial level, obviously COVID's affecting all kinds of institutions and businesses. The other thing that's really, really obvious is that post-Weinstein, post-Spacey, there is a cleaning house been going on in Hollywood, and that there's been a demand for it. And, well, again, this is a split.
You think it's a cleaning house, or I don't see Hollywood as doing anything noble. It's almost something, I think they're just offering somebody's not useful anymore, or some sacrifice.
Well, actually, I mean, I was thinking cleaning house in terms of there's a push from Me Too for that to happen. Okay. But actually, the other way of looking at it is when an operation or an organization, has to make some sacrifices when there's a shift of power, I think, was going on around Spacey in that time. Epstein, particularly, was the center player. It seemed to me that there was infighting. That's probably evidence of infighting. And so, yeah, some heads are going to roll, not just the ceremonial sacrifices, but also putting people in their place. You know, if certain players start getting too big for their boots, well, chop them off at the knees. Those kind of things are presumably going on all the time in Hollywood, as they are in organized crime, and presumably in intelligence agencies as well. So, but that would just suggest a beast that's licking its wounds and renewing itself and shitting out, you know, some toxins. I think there is something larger going on, which I address in the book as well, which I think is that we're being corralled into our technology. So we're being corralled, and Netflix is a sort of gateway drug here, away from the old Hollywood of sitting in movie theaters, which at least is a little bit community-based, to downloading directly into the tech, you know, having the apps that we need installed on our phones and then in our own bodies. So we're co-creating our own fantasy reality. And that, then they've really got us. So I think Hollywood maybe has outlived its uses in a number of ways, but that means it's fulfilled its function. We have been Hollywoodized, and now we're ready to volunteer for downloading into the cloud, so that we can live on forever in our own parasocial universe, probably for most people as some new member of the Avengers with his own customized superpower. You know, it's pretty deep. The level of denial and delusion and our addiction to escapist thing, I guess, is my point. It hasn't. Whatever's been crippled or seems to be dying now around Hollywood It doesn't include our addiction to the media.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate. I mean, in your book, 16 Maps of Hell, you do talk about the going to the store and getting comic books and sitting in your bed with a bag of crisps and cheese. And I was like, oh, that was a parallel to my childhood. That was what us outcasts and artists wanted to do. And what happened with the superhero movies has been, I'm sure you agree, just insane. I mean, even now, Jason, like my son, Sebastian, again, same as your brother, he loves the Black Panther, and he'll be sitting there watching the Black Panther, and he'll hear me walk by and goes, and I'll go like, damn it, why is the CIA guy the good guy? You know, that's the guy who plays Bilbo Baggins. I can't believe they did that. And he looks at me like I'm insane, but yeah. I just walk away. But it's incredible what they did with the comic books, there's heroes, isn't it?
How old is Sebastian?
He is 7.
Right, so he's a bit young for paranoid awareness.
I can, yeah. But I'm old enough to rant and rave like some senior citizen, though.
To be ignored for that.
Yeah, completely ignored.
Too old to get it, Dad. I'd find that very distressing. I mean, I found it distressing enough just writing about the Black Panther, or rather, you know, finding out what a big steaming pile of propagandic horseshit it was. And I tried to watch it as well, and I couldn't, and not because it was propaganda, but just because it was dumb, you know. Good for seven-year-olds, but the point being, not good for. I mean, very bad for, because it's a delivery device for these toxic narratives. So yeah, I would find that very hard. But at the same time, one has to. I mean, I'd have to acknowledge that for me, as a seven-year-old, those comic books were kind of lifesavers.
Exactly.
Fortunately, you know, they were just comic books, and they weren't so obvious. They've become useful as propaganda, and maybe they must have had that element to begin with, even if it was just at a personal level that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby had their own childhood trauma and were creating compensatory fantasies. You know, that's how it begins. That's how we're all complicit. But by now, yeah, they've been military industrialized into these massive products that really are overtly toxic and manipulative.
Yeah, well, again, hopefully that's why I keep hoping Hollywood would just go away. But right. Nate, as we get towards the end of the interview, do you have a question for Jason? I know you're a big Bowie and a big Talking Heads fan.
Oh my, yeah. Like, the Talking Heads have a great music video for Once in a Lifetime, done to Twin Peaks stuff. But yeah, David Bowie actually has a character named I'm not gonna say after me, but I'd be pulling back the curtain too fast. I wonder if you've read Infinite Jest, Jason, with all of this talk. And we can say spoiler free, no spoilers for anyone, but a basic concept from Infinite Jest is that there's entertainment that's basically just too good not to watch, and people are, as Roger Waters used the 1992 from the book, entertained to death. So I'm wondering if you have some kind of way you could tie that around. And I just like to add, by way of personal anecdote, if you look at Dark Journalist's recent video with Russell Targ, he has an interesting Leonard Cohen poster in the background. I share a birthday, like, basically with Cohen, Thomas Harris, Nick Cave, and Leonard Cohen. We're all born in the same Four Horsemen period. Thought I'd add that for Dark Art. It's all September 21st, 22nd birthdays around there. Of course, Harris being the Thomas Harris being the author of Hannibal Lecter. So that kind of is another culture shaper with the Tom Petty American Girl. But I hope you gathered my question from all of those literary devices and things, you know, littered throughout there. I'm wondering if you're familiar with this entertainment that's too good not to watch.
Only from Infinite Jest, and not from having actually read it or even attempted to. I think I did have a library copy for a brief period, but I gave up pretty fast, if memory serves. But I did pick up that bit, and if the whole book had been about that, I would have read it. And I picked it up, I think, from some of Wallace's other work as well. And it's reminding me now of the Monty Python skit about the joke that was so funny it was deadly. Did you ever see that?
Yes. Yes.
Coming to mind anyway. Yeah. Kind of similar, but this is the entertainment that's so entertaining that we actually can't turn it off, that it captures us forever. I think, well, that's speaking to exactly what I was just saying, isn't it? That we want it to be 24/7 and we want it to be full sense around, totally immersive.
Yeah, I think you write in your book that the goal, in tying back to superheroes, is to keep us in a state of assisted infantilization. Yeah. And you quote Marshall McLuhan, who says all forms of violence are quests for identity, which is what comic books teach us, and liberation through violence. And you even point out a very striking statistic that in comic books, most of the violence is done by the heroes, not the villains. So that's another wrinkle to the whole idea.
Well, the obvious analogy that I use in that, and I'm not sure how this relates to the violence, if I can relate it to, but is that the infantilization process, if we're going back into it, it ends with the womb. Like, that's the end point. If we reverse our trajectory and try and return to an infant state, what's the total, the apotheosis of that journey would be back into the womb. And the womb is an all immersive environment in which we're given everything we need. We're kept in exactly the right temperature, just total comfort, support, nourishment and nurturing. In my case, wasn't actually a very healthy environment, so probably that's true for others too, but still the best that we got, and it's the best we've had since then. Like, things certainly haven't got easier since we've come out of the womb. So that impetus to regress seems to correlate directly with the desire to immerse ourselves in entertainment, which is now immersing ourselves in the technology that entertains us. The medium is the message. Like, we've got, I think, and actually Spielberg made this comment that he was raised by a third parent, the television set. We've cross-bonded with the technology because it's fulfilled a function to us that's parental. So we emotionally bond with it. And then I said cross-bonded, that's a bit of a fancy term, but you can see how over generations we would be getting our consciousness spliced with technology in that way. And I think the violence, I think it does relate, because the child in the womb and the period after the womb, and this phase that I think we get stuck in, which is mother enmeshment, is when the identity is forming, when we're trying to find and forge an identity for ourselves. And it potentially is terrifying. Like the pull of the womb and the psychic influence of the mother, when we're in that liminal space where we've kind of got an identity but not quite, the presence of the mother, or that even internally the awareness of the mother, threatens to overwhelm that emerging self, and we get sucked back into it, which is partly what we want. We want to return to the womb and immersion, but the identity that's forming would also then have to experience its dissolution and destruction. So I think that then that what happens during that period, if it's not optimal, if it's traumatic, is that the way that the identity finds to establish itself is through violence, through pushing against, particularly violence against women, which is the central theme of 16 Maps of Hell, because the mother represents and even is the ultimate threat to our existence, as particularly as boy children. So then, yeah, we've got this push-pull thing going, where part of us wants to get re-immersed in the mother's body and the other part has to cut itself free. So then you have the killing of the women, and even in the Hannibal Lecter, or rather in Silence of the Lambs, that he's creating a woman suit out of the victims, the female victims, which is what Ed Gein was doing, who's right. The subject of the last chapter, 16 Maps of Hell. So and of course the this all reflects how the immersive fantasies that we want to escape into and disappear into, including the superhero movies, is primarily one of violence and destruction. Somehow those two things go together. Like, we want to escape into peace, but the environment that we're creating, that we are escaping into, is one of war, because that's the most immersive kind of fantasy that we know of, is one of mass destruction.
Well said. Yeah, you quote Hayden again in The Power of Ritual. In prehistory, the secret society's simple purpose is to conjure up infernal terrors and render each other assistance in keeping their women in subjugation. So, yes, the theory of violence against children, disassociation for children, trauma with the old Sparta way, and taking the magic of women and replacing the woman's womb with another womb is all over your book, and a sobering message, Jason, but something that's been going on in history. No hidden conspiracy there, as I keep saying.
Yeah, well, thanks for summing it up and for getting it. I'm sober just listening to your summation. It's quite grim, isn't it? I mean, I hope that there is some evidence of the exit. We didn't get to Talking Heads. Initially, initially my idea was, can I present a really positive cultural example and show what a positive influence it was in my life? And that what was Talking Heads. But
yeah, it's a wonderful chapter.
With some feedback, I realized that wasn't going to wash for people, because, you know, you could pick anyone and somehow you could see how it was positive. And I could take apart David Byrne and Talking Heads and find out there's all kinds of toxins in there. So I realized I needed to come up with a more persuasive, more legitimate exit. And that was Ed Gein. It was the opposite. I had to go deeper into the dark and say, well, wait a minute, there's something here that if I can really see it, I'll see the light. You know, if I can really look at this darkness, and I will see the light in that darkness. And this is the idea, the phrase.
I think it's there, Jason,
about integrating.
Yeah, I mean, your last chapter, your last paragraph is really beautiful, inspirational. That I can't even say the lines, but those two lines I've kept as a mantra. So it's there. It kind of reminds me of, I don't know if you've ever read Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, but it's so dark, 99% dark, but there's one sentence that sort of saves the entire novel. And that's what I see in your work. And there are sections that are poetic, they're inspirational, and really... Yeah, I don't see your book as completely dark. It's sobering, but it does have a positive message.
Well, I'm curious about these lines that you can't say. Is that because you don't want to ruin them?
Or, well, I don't want to give the ending of the book unless you don't mind it.
Oh, I don't mind. I don't think it'll be a spoiler, will it?
No. Here's the paragraph, and I thought it was beautiful. Since there is nothing finally that is not nature, there is nothing that can replace or distort or corrupt nature. There are only endless strategies of distraction, a marketplace of attention, and elaborately built devils to prolong our agony and delay our inevitable awakening. The forgetting chamber of hell plays endless reruns to keep us enthralled, but there are no movies in heaven. Beautiful.
Thanks. I'm glad that it landed, that last line. I was thinking after I'd published it, I should have added one more line, which is, and there are no maps of heaven.
Perfect. I'm going to write it down too.
In other words, there's not going to be a sequel to this book.
That too. No, I think you said it all. So awesome. But yeah, again, for the audience, so much more. So many more other movies and events and research that Jason brings in. We didn't even get to the Joker archetype and Heath Ledger and other his case studies, which are incredible. So, but I highly recommend you definitely get 16 Maps of Hell. And well, first of all, Nate, thanks for keeping us company.
Hey, thank you so much for having me, Jason. You do very intense and very thorough, and I think you do your soul's work, and I'm very grateful to have had this opportunity to speak with you, and thank you for what you've offered. And Miguel, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Nate. Thanks for saying that. It was good to hear.
Yeah, and Jason, you, for the audience, where they can find out more about you and where to purchase the book.
Yeah, same place, all in one place, horticulture, A-U-T-I, culture.com. Was a regular blog that I update, and there's a podcast that's weekly called The Limitless, the podcast between, and they can order the book at any page at the site in the sidebar, and also can contact me via the site. I always love to hear from listeners, readers, anyone who gets anything from what I'm doing. Feel free to reach out directly. It's Jason with a U at protonmail.com.
Wonderful. Yes, check it out, audience. I agree with Nate. Jason puts out important work. Well, Jason, as always, thank you very much for coming on AM Biden. Good luck with everything, including leaving society if you have to. I might be joining you.
Right. Well, I'll keep you posted there and see. I'm going to take it slow. I'm not going to try and leave the second womb all at once. Yeah.
Wait till the next season of Succession is over and then leave.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, Jason.
Okay. Bye, Miguel. Bye, Nate.
On board a westbound 747. Didn't think before deciding what to do. All that talk of opportunities, TV breaks and movies rang true. Sure. Give me a break. Give me.